This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Sesame Street is an icon around the world. The magical television show transports kids to a comforting place, all while learning their ABCs and 1-2-3s. Now the groundbreaking educational programs working to help refugee children and their families who've experienced trauma in conflict zones. Coming up, we speak to the International Rescue Committee about its $100 million partnership with Sesame Street. The award from the MacArthur Foundation will help the groups reach displaced children from Syria. We'll find out how they plan on doing that. That's later. Now, when civil war breaks out in a place like Syria, who are the people left behind? Sure, the people who don't have the money to leave, but also the helpers. They include ordinary residents and medical professionals who risk their lives despite the dangers and stress of war. In times of crisis, healthcare is needed more than ever before. Today, Where We Live, we'll hear from doctors in the U.S. who are working to help medical students in Syria. The training program is a collaboration between faculty and students at Yale University and the State University of New York, Albany. First, when's the last time you've heard news about Syria? To get an idea of what it's like for Syrians today in 2018, as the country moves towards 7 years now in a deadly civil war, joining me by phone is Dr. Lena Morad. She's a practicing nephrologist in the D.C. area, a former board member of the Syrian American Medical Society. She also is an active participant in that group's missions. Dr. Morad, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
As I mentioned, many listeners here in the U.S. May not have heard much about Syria recently. It's going on 7 years in March that civil war began there. Can you describe what's going on there in recent days?
Yeah. So what's going on in Syria is unlike any conventional wars where medical facility are destroyed, as a collateral damage. In the Syrian war, it's a Syrian regime, a dictatorial regime that is attacking healthcare facility deliberately, systematically, in an effort to displace civilians, to move out in areas that are supporting any rebellion against, the regime, and in this way basically affecting casualties on civilians who denying the access to any healthcare, basic human rights, which is access, to healthcare, maternity, children's vaccination, and so on. People have been displaced, from this area, and that's why you see the mass of refugees, 11 million, has been displaced just in a way to get, the basic human rights. This is what people, are forgetting, about, the Syrian war, and they think that just because we defeated the Islamic State that everything is over. Whereas, in reality, the humanitarian need has increased from 10 million last year to almost 13 million, this year.
Dr. Morad, you mentioned the civil war. When we think about that, we think of two clear sides. The situation in Syria is very complicated. There's many different groups that are all fighting each other. Can you lay it out for us?
That is true. I mean, there's many groups fighting, and it just unfortunately had become a politicized war with many major power involved in that area. The thing, that we concentrate on as physicians is the brunt that all the civilians are taking, the casualty. From group fighting, the civilians are the ones, who have been displaced and been denied the health care that they need.
You are a member or a former board member of the Syrian American Medical Society. You're a Syrian yourself. Tell me when you came to this country, how'd you get involved in this group?
So basically, we started the Syrian Medical Society, with the abbreviation is called SAMS. We started as any other medical professional society, a few members of a very small foundation. But since the war escalated in Syria, we found ourselves obligated to deliver humanitarian relief. And since 2012, we became one of the major medical providers of healthcare inside Syria. So we're a network of almost 1,000 physicians. We supported 3 million patients every year, 138 medical facilities, 2,000 Syrian staff of healthcare workers, who are delivering the healthcare. And we're doing everything to help them rebuild the destroyed healthcare system in order to continue the medical care in South Syria.
How do you help them when the civil war has been raging on, when the Assad regime, is blocking certain aid coming into the country? How do you help them?
So we have many things, going on. We have a lot of courageous doctors that are going, inside Syria. There's 100, that keep going inside Syria to help and train. We do a lot of training missions to neighboring countries in advanced cardiac support, in trauma surgery, and so on. And then, you know, we have medical missions that go on to neighboring countries, and we do healthcare, including cardiac caths, dialysis, you know, and so on, to all the refugees, you know, around, you know, the area. And now we're expanding even to the refugees in Greece and beyond. So we work on multiple levels, and, you know, we work with the social media to help, you know, the healthcare worker support them, and any questions that they have, you know, we can support them by phone. Mm.
I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we know that millions have been displaced, hundreds of thousands of Syrians killed. Who are the people that are left that are trying to provide health care?
So the people, you know, are really a bunch, you know, of courageous people. The latest statistic in 2017 showed that there's only one general practitioner for every 50,000 civilian left, and one specialist for every 200,000. So you can imagine, you know, it's a handful of doctors trying to provide health care to all the civilians left. And that's why we've seen increased number of casualties among normal deaths, you know, let's say heart disease and diabetes, mm-hmm. and kids starvation and lack of vaccination. So the war, you know, has taken a big brunt, you know, on civilians, not only from the destruction in the war itself, but from the lack of medical services. So we at SAMHSA are committed to providing any help, you know, we can to the few healthcare workers that are left, supporting them by salaries, sending medical supplies, training missions, and being available for them every moment of the day with anything, you know, the logistical support that they need.
This is Where We Live. I'm speaking with Dr. Lina Murad, practicing nephrologist in the D.C. area. She's a former board member of the Syrian American Medical Society, an active participant in the missions of that group as they try to help with humanitarian aid, also training of those that are still in Syria that to provide health care. We're going to be talking about a collaboration by Yale University and the University SUNY Albany in just a few minutes. But Dr. Murad, you mentioned that hospitals are still being attacked in Syria under the Geneva Convention. That's a war crime. What has been the response from the international community?
Yeah, unfortunately, there have been very little response from the international community. There have been a Security Council resolution, 2086, in May 2016, that condemned, you know, those attacks and declared them, you know, as war crime. There have been many recommendations, but nothing has been in basically implemented on the ground, because the major forces are the one involved in the war in Syria, and they're blocking any UN security resolution. So this is a war crime that's been, you know, going on with impunity, and unfortunately it's setting the precedent for future crises for other dictatorships, you know, to inflict, you know, on civilians.
With hospitals being bombed, are there clinics or other areas of care that have to really go underground so that they cannot be found?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, this you know, the war, you know, has gone, you know, through the 7 years, you know, into different crises. So we tried, you know, to fortify the hospitals, you know, at one stage. Then we tried to help people build in caves, you know, even underground. And the major attack, you know, from the Syrian regime were barrel bombs in the beginning, but then since the involvement in Russia with more targeted weapons and the use, you know, of the chlorine and other chemical attacks, had even targeted, you know, those underground hospitals and gassed people, you know, who are working in caves, you know, under hospitals. So, you know, unfortunately, every time, you know, we try to help, you know, healthcare workers, you know, to protect them, there have been more attacks, you know, and more targeted attacks. And that made Syria the most dangerous place for healthcare workers to practice in 2016 and 17.
When we think of healthcare professionals in this country, they're people with specific training and degrees. With so many people that have left, Dr. Murad, the people that are trying to help, what are their backgrounds, and how difficult is it for them to take care of these Syrians who are sick and wounded?
This is very difficult because, you know, even back in the good days, you know, in Syria, we did not have very strong what we call paraprofessionals, which is nurses and nurse practitioners and technicians, you know, like we have in the U.S. But now, you know, we're relying on those people to basically do the job, you know, of doctors. You know, we're training mostly technicians and nurses to do the work, you know, of physicians, because there are very few physicians left. For example, in Aleppo, under the siege, there was only one OBGYN doctor who was delivering all the C-section, all deliveries, you know, in that area. So she had to train, you know, midwives, you know, basically on the job training to take care of those people. So this is where we concentrated on our training, beside trying to build a new, you know, healthcare force by training medical students. And this is what's been also very, very difficult under the circumstances, as you can imagine.
I mentioned that you're from Syria originally, Dr. Murad. Personally, when you see this civil war going on for so long, when you see the devastation and the suffering, how has it impacted you?
Of course, you know, it's been extremely hard, you know, not only as, you know, as a Syrian, Syrian in origin, but any physician, you know, to see all this mass casualties, you know, to see the pictures, you know, of the kids, you know, that, that died unnecessarily, of starved people, of, you know, the massive, you know, destruction and the major injuries, you know, that you've seen that we've never, ever seen, you know, before. That by itself, you know, is heartbreaking. And to see civilians just fleeing, you know, destruction every single day and not being having access to the simple health care that, you know, we take for granted here in the U.S. has been extremely heartbreaking. Of course, you know, like everybody else, you know, we have our moment ups and very moments down, but you know, when you talk to people inside Syria and seeing their resilience, you can't help but, you know, get yourself together and keep going to try to help them.
I wanted to bring into our conversation now Dr. Hani Mawafi, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Yale Medical School, also Chief of the Section of Global Health and International Emergency Medicine. Dr. Mawafi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I understand you're an ER doctor with a degree in public health, a study of a humanitarian crisis as well. When you hear about what's happening in Syria, similarities with other conflicts that we've seen in recent years, and the challenges, the unique issues that are going on there.
Sure. So, unfortunately, attacks on healthcare are not limited to the war in Syria. It's been a phenomenon that for the last few decades, we've seen increases in the number of health workers killed initially through lack of protection, and now, as Dr. Murad said, through being directly targeted by the warring parties. I think it's important to understand the scope of what's happening in Syria. So the monitoring of violence in healthcare working group that just started recently is an effort to document these attacks on healthcare workers. And there's been just under 1,000 attacks on healthcare workers in, since the group started, over half of which happened in Syria itself. So the Syrian war is representing 50% of all the attacks on doctors and healthcare facilities and nurses and other healthcare workers in war around the world.
Now, I mentioned that you and your colleagues at Yale have collaborated with SUNY Albany. We're going to hear from a couple of gentlemen from SUNY Albany in just a little bit. But you've created a program to try to train medical students and others that are still in Syria, to train them in you know, medical procedures and in the study of medicine. How do you do that?
Well, it's not easy. What I would say, though, just to put a fine point on it, I don't want to say that we created the program, because the real heroes on the ground are the doctors and the nurses that have been there working kind of tirelessly under constant threat. And this is a problem that came up out of other work. Essentially, you know, my despite being an educator, most of what I was focusing on initially through working with SAMHS and the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations, an organization called OSSM, U-O-S-S-M, which is another Syrian expatriate organization, was analyzing the data coming from the health facilities, trying to help them understand what types of cases were being seen in the clinics, what the needs were, to help them plan for resource allocation and to document what was happening in the war. And really, this issue of education came up out of side discussions where in talking to doctors on the ground and meeting them in meetings in Turkey, they would say that the facilities are not just losing physicians and nurses from attacks. They're losing because some of the young physicians lose hope and then leave the country. So, I mean, it's estimated that, you know, Syria before the war had roughly 30,000 physicians, and there are estimates that say half of those physicians have left. So of those 15,000 that left, 1,500 of them are practicing in Germany, right? So, I mean, I think it's important for people to understand that the people that make the very expensive and difficult journey across land to get to Europe, these are the people with means. So physicians and their families typically have more resources and are able to make these trips. But that leaves a critical shortage of healthcare workers inside the country. And the ones that are willing to stay really needed support. So we began to talk to them to see in what ways could we best support. And they came up with the idea of, well, we have hundreds of students that graduate in each area around Syria that would like to stay. They want to make their life in the country. They want to help their fellow citizens. They want to become physicians and nurses. How can we help support them? And we went back and were ruminating. And the next time I contacted them, they said, well, we've already started the clandestine training. We've got the university essentially started, and we've got the first class accepted. So that really jump-started our efforts to figure out how to support them remotely.
And we're going to get into some of the tools that they're using to do this training remotely. Again, on the phone with me, Dr. Hani Mawafi, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Yale Medical School. Dr. Lena Morad, again, you're a former board member of the Syrian American Medical Society. When you hear about these collaborations that are growing between U.S. doctors, U.S. medical students to help in Syria, is there momentum behind this?
There is a big momentum, and we're very grateful to our colleagues, you know, all over the U.S. They've been approaching us, you know, actually, because they hear about what's going on, and they've been helping in many, many ways. Their physician all over the U.S. that are giving, like, you know, ER courses, you know, online. We're relying a lot on the social media and on the technology to deliver lots of courses, training missions. And the latest things that Dr. Mawafi and physician from Albany are doing, they're donating applications, you know, like online applications that the student in Syria can use, basically, to continue their medical education. And this is, you know, one last point, you know, I'd like, you know, to call for all American organizations, like such big organizations like, you know, Google's and Amazon, you know, hopefully they can hear this and they can donate tablets where application can be downloaded. I'm sure there are lots of medical schools, Dr. Mawafi can elaborate on this, you know, that are willing to donate medical applications. So if we have the tablets, we have medical applications, we can basically translate them to Arabic, you know, or add you know, some Arabic comment, you know, on this, and deliver a better education to a medical student in Syria, and hopefully build the next generation of physician who can replete the shortage, you know, that we have.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about the healthcare crisis in Syria. Because of the long civil war there, more than half of medical professionals that have fled the country. And we're talking about some of the initiatives here in the United States as to pair up with Syrians who are still there, who are willing to be there under the terrible circumstances of that civil war to help those that need care. I want to take a quick call before we head to break. Matthew's calling from Norwich. Matthew, go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi. I work in a community health setting as a mental health counselor, and I'm just wondering, you know, what, if any, kind of mental health care is still available in Syria or in the Middle East in general with a lot of the conflicts going on there?
A good question, Matthew. I'll let Dr. Mawafi, can you take that? He had a question about what kind of mental health care is in Syria at this time.
Sure. So mental health was an under-addressed area, I think, in Syria and throughout the Middle East. But thankfully, there has been an increase in the amount of services available specifically to people coming out of Syria that are refugees in the surrounding countries. Now, within Syria, There are still some mental health workers, not many psychiatrists and psychologists, but some trained mental health workers that are working in collaboration with professionals outside, both in the region and through organizations like SAMHSA and OSIM, to provide largely group counseling and then to have some monitoring of patients with known psychiatric conditions to make sure that they're able to maintain their medication regimens and stay under control.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I want to thank Dr. Lena Murad, a practicing nephrologist in the D.C. area. She participates in missions with the Syrian American Medical Society, also a former board member. Dr. Murad, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having us.
We've been talking about the ongoing civil war in Syria. It has many consequences, including the destruction of a healthcare system without new doctors and nurses to take the place of those who've left. Today, we're going to learn more about a training program led by faculty and students at Yale and also the University at Albany. They're trying to train medical students and others to do these very necessary procedures, the healthcare of people wounded and sick in Syria. Staying with us is Dr. Hani Mawafi, Associate Professor of Medicine at Yale Medical School. And after the break, we talked to two doctors who know what it's like to be displaced. Now, what are the challenges here in the U.S. and abroad to help those in Syria? We'll find out more and we'll take your questions too. 860-275-7266. And find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Attention on Syria is not very much these days. You can't find it very much in the U.S. media. It doesn't mean the conflict is over. Millions of Syrians have been displaced. Hundreds of thousands have died. Coming up, we'll hear about the impacts on refugee children and a unique collaboration to reach them and their families. It's involving Sesame Street. That's just ahead. First, we've been talking about a training program by the School of Medicine at Yale University and the Global Institute for Health and Human Rights at the University of Albany. On the phone with me, Dr. Hani Mawafi, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Yale Medical School, also Chief of the Section of Global Health and International Emergency Medicine. We've been hearing about some of the difficulties trying to reach people who are involved in healthcare in Syria, Dr. Mawafi. I understand that the medical students and others that you're helping through this collaboration, they call themselves Free Aleppo University. Now, how exactly did you connect with them?
So again, as I said, we were working with some physicians inside Syria to help support their delivery of healthcare and analyze the cases that they were seeing. And these same physicians ultimately, some of whom had been faculty members at Aleppo University prior to the war. As you probably already know, once the war started, many people who provided any type of health care to protesters or people accused of being protesters were then kind of separated from their jobs, were unable to continue their training. But many of these people continued to provide assistance and then wanted to continue in their initial mission of training other physicians. So they started this, what they called Aleppo University as well, but we convinced them that that was too confusing to have two institutions in the same place called Aleppo University. So they decided to call it Free Aleppo University, mm-hmm. which essentially was clandestine training of the people we were supporting were the healthcare workers, but they actually are teaching in many fields. Mm-hmm.
I guess what I'm getting at in the question about how you're connecting with them is when we hear about the devastating civil war, we wonder about the infrastructure, how easy it is to make a phone call, how easy it is to use a social media app. What are the tools that you're using?
Gotcha. So you cannot really make a phone call, but thankfully, one of the things that happened early on in the war was a real focus on communications. So initially, health facilities were using satellite internet connections, which are very expensive, but ultimately were a lifeline for many of these facilities. And while some have continued to rely on satellite internet connections, others now have access to fiber or DSL internet connections, specifically in areas that are further away from the fighting. And then through that, we're able to use Skype, Zoom, all of these conferencing apps, WhatsApp, Twitter, to maintain communications with students and faculty.
I wanted to bring into the conversation now Dr. Kamiar Alai and Dr. Arash Alai. They're brothers. They're both based in Albany. Dr. Kamiar Alai,
yes,
Associate Dean for Global and Interdisciplinary Research, Director of the Global Institute for Health and Human Rights, and also a professor at the Rockefeller School of Public Affairs and Policy at University of Albany. You and your brother Arash are joining us from the studios of Northeast Public Radio. So first, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
I'm going to start with Arash Alai. And I hope you don't mind if I use your first name so that our listeners can tell which Alai, Dr. Alai we're speaking with. But Arash, how did you hear about, how did you pair up with Yale in helping train these medical students from these remotely by using these social media apps that we heard Dr. Mawathi mentioning?
So I wanted to go back to give you and your audience idea how we involved in this project. So Kamiar and I originally from Kermanshah city, which is western part of Iran. And we grew up in 80s when it was war between Iraq and Iran. We have been several times internally displaced. We studied in tent. We studied in numbers of villages and city. And because of that, when we saw numbers of students in Syria have been displaced internally and refugee in Turkey, that was our passion to help them. Because of that, we started to go to Turkey several times and talk to Turkish Higher Education Council and numbers of university to find opportunity to help those numbers of students we saw in mass media. Then later we shared this idea with Dr. Mawafi and Dr. Khoshnut, and they informed us they are going to have seminar and they wanted to invite numbers of doctors who are working inside of Syria. That was great opportunity for us to be in touch with Yale colleagues and with Syrian doctors who wanted to help numbers of students to continue their education.
You mentioned you understand what it's like to be displaced. I'll ask your brother, Kamiar, you were also arrested in Iran for doing public health programming.
Yes. As you may know, before I was arrested, my brother and I, we lived in Iran, and there was 8 years war between Iran and Iraq. And we were, you know, in the city, in the border, which was affected by the war. And we went through all of those situations of how it's difficult that you have to be relocated daily basis, but you wanted to continue your education.
And because of your experience, you see how doctors and other medical professionals are caught in the crosshairs when conflict happens, where you're hearing that they're being targeted, where hospitals are being bombed. We heard Dr. Mawafi say earlier that the students who are there who are still being trained, it's important for them to still have hope. How do you instill hope in these people you're trying to help?
This is, you know, very important point because, you know, when we have been in touch with a student, in the beginning we had, you know, we didn't have any idea how we wanted to deliver this course when they are in that situation every day, you know, challenge to survive. Now we wanted to talk to continue higher education for them, to deliver high-level course, academic course. But when we had opportunity to be in touch with them through those platforms that Dr. Mawafi said, we found they have passion. 51% of our students are girls. They wanted to be doctor to provide service, and they don't wanted to leave their country. So that was huge passion from them to give us energy to develop this program.
Well, when we think about medical school, I mean, all of our guests would know better than me, but think about the certain courses you would take, or I'm just wondering how, when you're talking about using apps and Skyping, like how you can get certain information across when maybe they don't have the certain textbooks in front of them, so to speak. I'll ask Arash to answer that.
So, as you may know, these students, they have the unique situation. For example, the first challenge is safety and security. They have to be relocated daily basis. So there's no permanent place that they can continue to study. Some of them, they have to study in the basement. Others, they may be finding a safe restaurant to continue the education. So that was the first challenge, that we had to deliver courses online. But the second challenge was, most of them, it was the first time that they had any kind of online education. So we wanted to have some kind of preparation for them. The other challenge was language barriers, because most of them, they speak Arabic but not English. So we had to identify and recruit bilingual co-instructors that they could translate all of those courses from English to Arabic. The other challenge was that the students, they used to have interaction with their professors, so we had to add synchronized component to asynchronized, you know, education. So we added live sessions. The other challenge was that most of them, they didn't have laptop or computer. So we worked with Department of Computer Science to develop an application that they could use with the smartphone, because fortunately, more than 90% of them, they had a smartphone, different kind of a smartphone. So they were able to use those kind of application. The other challenge was access to internet, because they had very limited time that they could access to internet through the satellites from the border countries. So we developed like an offline platform that they could use during the time that they don't have access to internet. Mm-hmm. So step by step, we learn and we improve the quality of services. The other challenge was that initially we recruited a doctor who was a physician from Iraq, and he was fluent in Arabic. But we didn't know that Syria is the only Arabic-speaking country that they have their own medical terminology in their own language, which means they couldn't communicate with other doctors with respect to medical terminology. So we had to identify Syrian doctors to deliver some of those courses. And that was a motivation for us to deliver online intensive language program for our students. So that was a good opportunity for our students to improve the English language and also medical terminology for them. So in the future, they can use any kind of medical textbooks without any problem. So it was a progressive effort that over the time, we learn, we share with them. We had a continuous evaluation. We received feedbacks from them, and we were very impressed how much those students are dedicated. The other interesting thing we found, that traditionally some of those students, they were separated by gender. So some of them, they express that they appreciate this online platform because that gives them an opportunity that they can interact with the other gender. So girls can understand how boys are thinking. So it was a kind of friendly environment among those students.
Can you describe the situation that your students with this program are under today in 2018? As we mentioned earlier in the show, there's not a lot of attention on what's happening in Syria. A lot of the discussion, especially in this country, is looking at the refugee crisis and who to permit to come into this country. Europe is dealing with so many of the displaced that are looking for a new home. But each day, another day moves forward in Syria, and these are students that are trying to help. What is it like for them? What do they have at their fingertips to do this work? Kamiar.
So they are very dedicated students. The average age is between 18 to 25. They were very gifted students among several of their fellow classmates. And they were very committed to stay in Syria because, as you know, a significant proportion of doctors or medical professionals, they decided to leave the country, which is reasonable. But these are those who wanted to stay to help their, you know, fellow citizens. And as you know, a lot of people, they get injured daily basis. So these students, they wanted to be healthcare providers in the future to help those people. So they were very passionate and motivated, you know, to learn and to apply some of things that they learned from those online classes. And also as a peer educators and peer counselor to help the younger siblings or family members, how they can apply to this kind of, you know, online education and how they can coach them during the academic environment.
In addition to Kamiar's point, I want, if it's possible, I wanted to add some, you know, information, share with some information and activity we have, you know, because we found those students, they have been isolated in their country, and now they, we wanted to have them to be in touch with the other students outside of Syria. Because of that, we send announcement to our student not only in Albany area, in United States. Now we have numbers of volunteer students, and we connected them to those students in Syria. This connection, as Kamiar mentioned, we have in addition to that intensive English language program. They learn from each other inside of Syria and outside of Syria. Syrian student, American student, and international student. They share their experience, they share their culture, and they improve their each knowledge. In addition to that, we change some of the course to be more practical. For example, for mental health, you ask question, what is the facility for mental health care inside of Syria? There is lack of, you know, professionals inside of Syria. We are going to change our courses to be more practical. Numbers of course will be psychology course for those students, how they can protect themselves and how they can be service provider as a because they don't have psychologists, as a health care worker in their family and in their community. These are type of, you know, interaction between Syrian students and outside.
You're hearing from Dr. Arash Alai, independent expert on HIV/AIDS and higher education based in Albany, and his brother, Dr. Kamiar Ali, associate Alai. I'm so sorry. I'm having trouble saying your name today. And this is someone with a name like Nalpathanchil, Associate Dean for Global and Interdisciplinary Research, Director of the Global Institute for Health and Human Rights, and Public Service Professor at Rockefeller School of Public Affairs and Policy at University of Albany. These men, along with Dr. Hani Mawafi from Yale, who's on the phone with us, are all working on a remote program to help train medical students in Syria. I wanted to go back to Dr. Hani Mawafi at Yale. How do you measure success of this program when we hear about all of the challenges? And what are your long-term hopes in this collaboration, Dr. Mawafi? Dr. Mawafi, are you there? Oh, I don't think I hear him anymore. So I'll throw that question to the brothers, Dr. Kamiar and Dr. Arash Alahi. How do you measure success when you think about these challenges?
So we have, you know, each 3 months evaluation. And we share this evaluation with numbers of faculty members at Yale, at Harvard, and South Carolina to see that, and, you know, individual expert and help us. Because, you know, when we wanted to start this program, we couldn't find any previous experience to deliver higher education courses for internally displaced medical student. Because of that, we wanted to ask volunteers, ask other universities to come to help us, because we have, as I mentioned, each 3 months one evaluation. We have survey, we have, you know, a live discussion with our target group to know how we can solve barriers and how we can improve the quality of program in the future, because we hope to learn from this pilot and scale it up for worldwide. There is no, you know, debate to say, you know, it's only in Syria we can see this challenge. There is numbers of challenge and war in and conflict in other parts of the world. We need to come with big platform and have available program for those students who wanted to continue their education.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kamir Alahi and Dr. Arash Alahi, both men working again to help train medical students remotely, the ones that are in Syria, helping the sick and wounded there. Also, thanks to Dr. Hani Mawafi, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Yale Medical School. We hope to get an update from you in the near future. Thanks again for joining us today from the studios of WAMC in Albany. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, the impact of trauma on children can follow them throughout their lives. Now a unique collaboration between Sesame Street and the International Rescue Committee aims to help children and their families who live in refugee camps. More after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The refugee crisis caused by the civil war in Syria has many consequences, including the toxic stress it's caused more than 12 million children who've been displaced. Late last month, the MacArthur Foundation awarded a $100 million grant to a partnership between Sesame Street and the International Rescue Committee. Their aim is to help these refugee children and their families. One of the people behind the idea is a Connecticut resident who works for the International Rescue Committee based in New York City. Joining us by phone is Katie Murphy, Senior Technical Advisor for Early Childhood Development at the IRC. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lucy. It's great to be on.
First, congratulations on this grant. $100 million is a dream come true for many nonprofits.
It really is. No, it's amazing. We're still really on cloud nine.
When we talk about the refugee crisis, we think about the basic necessities. Not a lot of attention on thinking about toxic stress among refugee children and how it impacts their early learning. How did IRC and Sesame Street even think to pair up to do this, to make this their goal to help these children?
Well, you're exactly right. It's an issue that's been neglected largely by the humanitarian sector, even though we know from decades of research and scientific knowledge that the early years of life are the most sensitive for children in developing the brain architecture that really form the foundation for future learning and future functioning and have long-term impacts on children's health and well-being. So we knew that Sesame Street has such a powerful potential to influence not only the lives of young children, but also families around the world. They have a long history of international productions, as well as the shows that we all know and love in the United States. And so it was a natural partnership that emerged even before we had any funding available to us. But then when we saw this opportunity from the MacArthur Foundation, when they were announcing this first ever competition for $100 million for any solution to a critical problem of our time, we knew that this was the type of initiative that this would enable us to kind of make these dreams come true and really restore hope and opportunity for children whose lives have been uprooted by crisis and conflict.
Katie, when we think of Sesame Street, obviously access to a television, when we think of refugee populations, do the people that you're trying to help, do they have access to the programming that you're talking about, that you're working on creating?
They do. We've actually found that very high penetration rates, both for televisions as well as mobile telephones. So there's a lot of opportunities for digital content that can be shared across things like WhatsApp or text messages or even Facebook that families are accessing on their phones. But it's important to recognize that we're not only thinking of the sort of mass media component. That's a really important piece of this initiative. We will be creating new types of characters and programming that really reflect the reality of children's lives within the region, and that can be spread through broadcast television and mobile phones. But we also know that for children who've experienced such extreme distress, and for their caregivers, that there's a real need for direct services. And so our initiative also includes that kind of face-to-face personal interaction through home visiting services, through preschool-type programming that would be offered to complement the mass media initiative as well.
When we look at the mass media initiative, Sesame Street, for many years has created characters for all different types of children so that when they're watching something, they see someone like them. I wanted to play a clip. This is one of the new Muppets that Sesame Street created named Tauntaun. Actually, it was part of a presentation by Sesame Street and IRC to the MacArthur Foundation. Let's hear a clip from Tauntaun.
I have a new best friend. Her name is Amal. She's for Lichtington, and she's from Syria. Yes, and we like to sing and dance, and we count like this.
That's great.
Like this, Monsieur. Wahad, etnin, tlati, arba.
Very good.
So you hear Tauntaun counting in Arabic. What are some of the characters that you think will relate to these children you're trying to reach in Syria?
Well, this is something that will be developed in the early stage of this initiative, so it's not necessarily been finalized yet. But as you say, Sesame is so wonderful at creating characters that really reflect the reality of children's lives. And they use local language, and they ensure that the dress that the characters wear, it really resonates with the children and the families, so that it really becomes something that they see as their own, not something that's a U.S. Import that they're watching on their screen, but something really homegrown. And my colleagues from Sesame could talk much more about this, but they work very closely with the with local creative teams and producers to ensure that that content is culturally relevant.
We talked about toxic stress among children. Their parents and caregivers are going through a lot of stress and trauma themselves. How do you reach them when you mention these home visits as part of this project?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I mean, we know that early childhood development begins in the first critical years of life. And during those years of life, the family and particularly the primary caregivers are the most powerful influences on the child. And so ensuring that they are emotionally stable, able to respond to a child's cues, able to engage in play and communication activities, and to provide stable and comforting routines for a child is something that's critical for the family's overall well-being. And so we've looked at a broad array of evidence-based programs on how to kind of restore those types of skills and caregivers, and are drawing from proven models that have long-term impacts on child development as well as caregiver well-being. And sometimes just having that support of a familiar face that comes into your home on a regular basis that, you know, apart from providing practical strategies and tips, also just sort of is a friend and able to kind of help problem solve about some of the difficult stresses of life that are associated with living in displacement and having experienced things that are really unthinkable to many of us.
And how soon before this project is on the ground? I understand IRC and Sesame has a pilot in Jordan, but how soon before you'll be reaching these children, caregivers in Syria?
So we have, IRC has existing programs that it has been running for several years in response to the Syrian crisis, as well as programs around the world. And so we will be adapting and building and strengthening and expanding those programs through the following years and infusing them with Sesame content and this mass media initiative, which we're really excited about. So it's ongoing. We have programs that are serving these families and children currently, but to expand to the level that we've proposed in this initiative will take likely a year to get to the first sort of larger scale group of recipients, and then the initiative itself is 5 years. So we'll be able to, throughout the course of 5 years, not only through direct services with IRC, that's media, but also working with local governments, with NGO partners, with UN agencies, to ensure that this is broadly disseminated and something that can
and
really
Katie, we're actually running out of time, but I do want to thank you, a senior technical advisor for early childhood development at the International Rescue Committee. IRC and Sesame Street just awarded a $100 million grant to help refugee children and their caregivers. Katie, thank you for giving us a glimpse into the project. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And this is Where We Live.